Welcome to the New Zealand Tech Podcast, presented by Paul Spain and Anne Guests.
Welcome along to the New Zealand Tech Podcast, episode 167. I'm Paul Spain.
Hi all, I'm Wal Reed.
And I'm Bill Bennett.
Welcome along to the show, guys. Great to have you here.
Evening.
Nice to be here.
Now, Bill, remind us where you, for those that aren't regular listeners, where you fit into the technology community?
I write stuff about technology for a living. You can find me on my website, which is digital without the A, .co.nz, and Bill Bennett NZ on Twitter.
Excellent.
Right. Unlike my esteemed colleagues, I am a tech enthusiast. Also work in the tech industry, training on electronic consumer goods products.
Well, much like us then. So, yeah, tech enthusiasts all around. Excellent. Well, let's jump right in. Now, first up, interesting story that was in the New Zealand Herald about the flight centre being hacked was the story. Now, these guys are before the courts at the moment. The headline was Flight Centre's $123,000 attack by hackers. Now, we don't really know the full story behind the situation, but what we're aware of is that the flight centre had a bunch of these MasterCard cash passports, which are basically prepaid well, they're debit cards, aren't they, that I guess they sell or provided to customers in some form. And, I mean, what we've heard so far suggests that they had the information about these cards stored somewhere either on their premises in a physical sort of print form, or maybe the cards were accessible. Usually those things you need to scratch to get at the numbers, or in a digital form that wasn't secure enough. So the two accused were able to get at that information. So my question to you guys, is that really hacking? Unless they came in from outside the organisation, tunnelled into their network and broke in and stole them, which I'm not sure if that's actually the case here.
Yeah, I was going to say it's a crime story, not a technology story, isn't it?
It does. It sort of seems that way. It's hard to know the tech elements to it. If an organisation is handling that sort of information, that data should be encrypted so that people can't get it. And there's certainly rules around real credit cards. Now, because these are debit cards, maybe they've sort of flaunted what would be the rules if they were credit cards, and they've stored them in a very loose manner that's left the flight centre at risk and out of pocket for $123,000.
Well, the tech angle is a little bit of fear of security online. Bit of fear of security when anything to do with computers. It's, you know, techno fear more than story.
Yeah, I get that all the time whenever I go out. It's the fear of losing your credit card or someone taking your number and the receipt and pilfering, but I don't know, yeah.
Well, I guess, there's a couple of good points here. One is that, not that often because it's kept under the radar, but you do hear of businesses, if you're close enough, to them. Businesses often have fraud situations that come up, but more often than not, they don't get to court and they don't get to the media because the business doesn't always want the story to be out in the public. But in this case, they're going to the full extent of the law.
But Paul, fraud goes back, you know, 200-300. It goes back ever since we've had money. It goes back to Roman times, for heaven's sake. The thing is that money these days is tied up with computers, so computers always play a role now in any modern fraud. It's that straightforward. Like I say, it's not really a computer story. Mm-hmm. It's like saying that a Formula One race is a computer story because there's computers driving the parts of the car.
Well, the flip side is that everything is a technology story because technology is in everything. So that's why we talk about everything from cars to electronic money fraud.
It's like Elvis everywhere.
No, I prefer tech to be everywhere, Bill.
He's just left the building, Bill.
Yeah. All right. Well, fascinating anyway that this one has sort of come public, but I think I'm pleased that the Flight Centre have gone through the process. The other point I wanted to mention is that my understanding is that all the money that was lost off their customers' cards Flight Centre, I believe, have picked up that tab. So, you know, I think that that shows they're taking full responsibility, as a bank does in most cases in this country. If you lose money through fraud on a credit card or from your bank account. But it is worth noting, in some countries, and certainly for businesses, those levels of protections don't apply.
That's right. Have the blokes been sentenced yet?
Not as far as I'm aware. Yeah. I think it's just gone before the courts, right. which is why it's been in the Herald today. But yeah. No doubt we'll hear about that in due course, and they'll probably get a small slap on the hand.
Well,
and,
I was thinking, will they get the same kind of sentence that someone who nicked the 120 grand out the till would get? Yeah, that happens too.
It does. Yeah.
But often again with those sorts of things, that they're kept well under the radar as well, aren't they?
I'm sure the flight center will be reviewing their security procedures a bit more, so they won't be flying blind.
Now on to Vodafone. Now we had a good chat with Tony Baird last week about what was happening with Vodafone's network. Some interesting bits and pieces there. Something that I forgot to bring up with him, and not really his area, because he's more the network guy rather than sort of marketing. But I got the letter this week, and it had been announced a little while ago around some changes with Vodafone's plans. And in my case, they said, oh, look, we've bumped you from a 200 gigabyte data plan to a 250. Aren't we good? There's no extra charge. By the way, the double your data option that we used to have, which off the top of my head was $30 or $35, where they would give me another 200 or, presumably 250. It was 200. That was, around $30 or so. They said, look, people didn't like that too much. They had to buy that big chunk, and they might have only needed a little bit. So we're moving to a model where, look, you can just pay for what you need. Isn't that great? And by the way, it's $1 a gig. So if you need another 200 gigs and you've used up your 200, it's going to cost you $200 on top, even though your first 100, your first 200, probably costs you under $100.
Yeah, I used to have bills like that with my first internet account back in the dial-up days, 20-odd years ago. I remember once I got a $300 bill because we went over, but that was like probably 30 megs or something ridiculous.
Yeah. I don't know. How do you guys feel about that? It used to be for me when I would go over, sometimes, I would just go a little bit over.
Yeah.
But there've certainly been situations over the last, year or two where I've gone over and I've been appreciative that I can actually get that whole block again. Now, if I go over, I'm going to be really cautious because I can use 10 gigs in a day, right? Yeah. Quite easily.
I've got 200 gigs, but I hardly ever reach that.
Right.
Somebody like, who might be into gaming or whatever or downloading more, you might, $1 a gig is probably a bit of a rip, I would say.
Yeah, I get nowhere near that amount at the moment.
But if you use it, and let's say you go over by 20%.
I was going to say, but isn't there an option to dial back the speed?
No. And I think most people now don't want to do that. No, it's no longer broadband if you dial back the speed, but just a fair price for it. I think $1 a gig nowadays is just feels a little bit.
I was going to be the old man here and go back 20 years when the internet was fresh and new. The first time we bust our cap by a lot, the ISP waived it because
no one had ever done that before.
Well,
on 50 kbps.
Yeah, but also because we've been a good customer, paying the bill monthly for month after month after month. I'd hope there's some sort of leeway in Vodafone. If they're not dialing back the speed, then I don't know. It strikes me that there's almost a benefit for them if they can trap you into going over that and racking it up.
It's interesting. Anyway, I just thought I'd point that out because there is a lot of great innovation that our carriers are doing, and I like some of the things that Vodafone are doing. I happen to be one of their customers, and that's something that I don't like. And I think it's an important part of, I guess, what we do here on the NZ Tech podcast. If we see something that relates to New Zealand consumers, that's hurting us from time to time, we should just put our hand up and let them know.
Well, what you're going to see is you're going to see examples of parents getting bill shock on their accounts if that happens. And I don't think I don't think Vodafone's going to want to see those headlines in the papers or the news.
No, it seems to be more.
I mean, fortunately, it's not the old going to be. Hopefully, not the old bill shock where people get thousands of dollar bills. But you know, still, you use double your data. Yeah. Your $30 bill's gone up to $200 or $250. But I mean, that's it. They do send the warning emails and all that sort of stuff, whether you know whether they get seen or not. But yeah, I like the old system better, or maybe they should give you both.
Well, you've got to remember,
pick and choose. Say, look, yeah, I'll pay the double your data at $30 or $40, or you can pay a dollar a gig. That way, they would appease people like me.
But you know, it brings up the other thing, and that is that New Zealand's. I mean, apparently, most countries have some kind of data cap, but they're much much higher than the caps we got in New Zealand.
Are they really?
Well, I'm constantly told by readers.
Are we benchmarking Australia?
Yeah. Look, the thing is I do talk to people overseas who've got uncapped plans.
Yeah.
But I don't think they're as common as some people like, you know, Kim.com would have us believe that everyone's got them elsewhere.
That's because he's feeling good.
But it does bring that up as a question, is, you know, how much is a gig worth? What's the marginal cost to Voda?
Oh, yeah.
Well, it won't be a cent, will it?
It's almost like a revenue-grabbing thing, you know, with parking tickets and that. And you think you want to be incentivized being a consumer. You don't want to put, you know, it seems to be a user pays.
It's bad marketing, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, but anyway, thanks Vodafone for the extra 50 gigs, but if you can change that bit... we'll be happier. Now, on to a shiny piece of technology that we have sitting here on my desk, plugged into my 32-inch screen.
Looks like a juicer. That's got an Apple on it.
The new Mac Pro. So, got my hands on this a week or two back, and been having a bit of a play around. Now, this is an absolute sort of storming high-end video production workstation, or whatever other high-end sort of tasks that you want to do. But it's been pretty interesting having a play with it. The capabilities of it, it's for those that like their tech specs, this particular one has a 12-core Xeon CPU. Which is really, you know, primarily designed for really high end, workstations and for servers. 32 gigs of RAM, and this has got it's got dual video cards in it as well from Apple, and it can drive three concurrent 4K monitors or six concurrent full HD screens. So it's more than capable, sort of your average workloads, and starts at about $5,000, depending on what sort of, you know, spec you're after.
I don't even have one 4K panel, but it looks like a beast.
Well, most of us don't, but I think for the high end video editing, this is the bit that sort of really interests me. In the session that I did with Apple, we went through some of the things that they showed me in terms of its performance on video editing was extremely impressive, just in terms of the lack of sitting around waiting, which you expect to do with big video files and, you know, high definition imagery. And there just weren't those sort of delays when we were, you know, playing around with a whole lot of videos on Final Cut Pro.
I want to put that price into perspective. I was thinking about that before we came on air.
Mm.
30 years ago, the Mac first appeared, and I had one about 3 months after two or 3 months after they first arrived, within weeks of them arriving in Britain, where I was living at the time, and it cost me about £2,500. At that time, there were close to four New Zealand dollars to the pound, so we're talking about $10,000. In New Zealand money.
Wow.
And $10,000. And let me tell you, $2,500. I bought my wife a car the same year that cost us £900. Brand new, I should say. A new car. So, in relative terms, this is, well, it's way cheaper than that in relative terms. It's about the same price in, you know, in dollars. The price of these things has come down so it keeps coming down,
doesn't it? I mean, people will say, well, the new Mac Pro is actually more expensive than the previous Mac Pro, and there's a difference, but we've got a lot more inside this in terms of the SSD storage and the you know, the dual video cards and so on.
And it's a professional system. It's not a toy. It's not something, you know, you put in the kid's lunchbox. It's
yeah. I think there'll be a few people that'll be buying this machine because it is actually a pretty funky machine. But you know, generally this is really aimed at those who are using Macs for doing real production workloads, and you know, time is money. And you know, if they can make somebody more productive whose you know, time is worth, you know, whatever it is, $100 an hour or so, it doesn't take too long to actually pay for a machine like this.
It wouldn't get my word processing going any faster.
No, that comes down to you, Bill, to get that work done faster. So yeah. But I mean, by the time you build one of these up with you know, all the right bits and pieces, 4K monitors and so on, you know, there'll be situations where people are spending, you know, $30,000 to get you know, to get the right setup in place. So you know, that base sort of 5K price is really just the starting by the time you add in you know, the new 4K definition you know, screens and the like.
I got to upgrade my stuff now.
We all got to throw it all out and start again. Isn't that the way of it in the technology world?
Ultra SD to 4K.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but very nice piece of equipment.
It looks nice.
And Apple seem to have put quite a bit of effort into making their software really take advantage of it, and that particularly with in the video editing space. So, and that's, I guess, one of the keys. If you're going to put the graphics cards in there, is to get them doing as much of the processing as you can. Not that the 12 core CPU is a laggard by any means. That's pretty powerful as it is, but leveraging the video cards as well makes it very, very fast.
So is this wildebeest of a hardware, is that available at the moment to buy?
Yeah, so yes and no. They officially launched in December, just a few days out from Christmas. But pretty quickly, when you went online to have a look at ordering, the availability date was February, and when I looked a few weeks ago, that was bumped out to March. So yeah, I think they're in pretty hot demand. And Apple haven't done much of a refresh in their Mac Pros line for a while. Now the downside that people are complaining about is the old Mac Pro was huge. Now this is quite a small. Quite a small beast, 5 kilos in weight, so it's reasonably hefty, and it relies on what they call the thermal core to keep it cool. So it's very, very quiet.
Yeah.
But in terms of expandability, most of that happens on the outside. So it's got 6 of these 20 gigabits per second Thunderbolt ports that you can plug, you know, whatever external storage into you want. And it's going to be extremely quick. And I guess that's now with Thunderbolt, we don't necessarily need to have all these things internal to the machine, because the external connections are just as fast.
So are people complaining that it's not as big?
Well, I guess it's that we can't fill it up with hard drives type of story that people are used to doing with, you know, these workstation type machines where you can, you know, put a few dry RAID array or whatever, you know, set of disks inside. With this, the disks have to go you know, externally, other than the SSD. And you can, they offer up to a terabyte SSD internally. So, yeah, you can actually do a lot on that internal drive if you choose to. Obviously, if you're working with a lot of 4K video, then you can chew through a 1 terabyte disk pretty quickly too. So having that external storage is definitely, relevant.
Probably use those on the next Hobbit movie, maybe.
Well, I think there's all sorts of things that certainly could be done with them. I think they've pretty much finished all the movies, haven't they? In terms of I guess there's still work going on for the next one. But now, I guess looking back, Bill, that original Mac, what were your thoughts of it? Last week being the 30th anniversary of the Mac, what was it that sort of twisted your arm to make that, you know, purchase?
I went to the press conference and I thought, I must have one of these because this is what computers are going to be like in the future. Now, I've got to point out that at that time, the machines that we had were things like CPM and I think the original IBM PC had come along, but it was pretty
green. Mostly looking at green yeah. screens yeah. with plain text. Nothing had a mouse. Nothing had any sort of graphical user interface.
That's right.
Of any note.
And I was working on a couple of magazines in London, Practical Computing and Your Computer, and we had one into the offices. We'd actually previously had a Lisa in, which was like an earlier version of the Mac.
That's right, yeah.
But then we had
a lot more expensive and bigger.
Yeah. Well, we had the Mac in, and I just sat down for a play with it to, you know, write about it, as you do in the job. And I just thought, this is how computers will be, you know, in the future.
Mm.
And it just had that feeling to it. But it also had graphics, which it seems hard to explain now, but graphics did not exist on computers at that point. I mean, if you were drawing something on a printer, on a dot matrix printer, I should point out, you would use a graphics character set, like an 8-bit character set, and you'd have to piece these things together to do drawings and so on, unless you had a graphic.
It's like making an image up out of a set of tiles with logos on them and things.
Or alternatively, you would use a graph plotter, but you wouldn't.
That was very, very basic, wasn't it?
Yeah,
in terms of the computer output that you could get off a dot matrix. And then really, I mean, when the Mac came along, it really did, you know, change everything, didn't it?
Absolutely. And it was much easier to use. And yeah, the 128K model was a bit of a pain. You had to swap the disks around if you wanted to store your Word document, or you had to copy the word processor onto a disk to use and so on. It's quite painful by modern standards. But again, floppy disk drives were relatively new at that point. And it was a very powerful beast, and you could do things that you couldn't do on other computers. And sure, it had a small screen. Sure, the keyboard was wasn't as great as some other keyboards, but it was instantly obvious that you were going to be more productive with this little thing than you would have been with the things that it replaced. In my house, I think it replaced a very, very basic CPM machine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember getting the Mac Plus in sometime in the late 80s. And, I mean, any time going near a Mac was just such a different experience than going near, a PC of the time. They all looked the same.
Yeah.
The attempt of, Windows 1 and Windows 2, as graphical operating systems when they came out was very, very poor. And the fit and finish of the Apple, was just something that, it's hard to sort of describe. I felt there was an emotional connection with the, of the whole experience that you didn't have working with any other piece of technology, because there was that mix of the design mix, I guess, like when you walk into a beautifully architected building, this was beautifully architected hardware from top to bottom and throughout the operating system and how you interacted with it. And there wasn't any other experience like it in computing, was there?
No. People would talk about it being intuitive. Well, that's not true. It's not intuitive. I mean, you don't come out of your mother's womb knowing that you've got to move a mouse across a screen to do things. But my word, it was easy compared with anything else at the time. It was just, everything was easy and quicker. And you could give it to people that hadn't used a computer before, and they could be doing stuff on it within I wouldn't say minutes, but certainly within, an hour or so, they could be doing something, which just wouldn't do that on a previous machine.
Mm.
So it really did change everything.
Yeah, and there were lots of just really little things that were so nicely done, from just when you turn it on to the sound of it.
Yeah.
Which is odd today when everything makes a nice sound when you turn it on, so you don't even think about it. But the sound that it made when it came on, you wanted to eject the floppy disk and you'd drag it on screen and it would, pop out with a nice little sound.
What's
and so on.
The it's, sound it's, the Apple make? Because I'm totally Apple illiterate.
It's funny. I can't remember the ding that it used, exactly what it sounded like, the original sort of ding that it used to make when you turned it on.
But, I'm not going to sing it.
Come on, Bill.
But it did, yeah.
But, I mean, computers in those days didn't really know how to make a noise other than just a very very simple beep, the error-type beep. Yeah. Nothing friendly. And, right. I guess, that was one of those things. So, good fun to reminisce.
Oh, yeah.
And I guess the pleasing thing is that Apple is still around and is still designing some rather nice products as we can see here at the moment. So, but a bit more of a competitive market, shall we say, than it was back then.
Yeah.
And many of the things that were totally unique to Apple, of course, yeah, you can't be unique in the market for too long before people will look at what you do and emulate it and compete in various ways and so on.
I wouldn't say Apple's had 30 years at the front of the industry, but it's had it's been, you know, up there for 30 years, and it's certainly been no other company has had that influence over what we're doing today with computers. Love them or hate them.
Now, there have been some varying reviews on the Jobs movie. Have either of you seen it?
Not no. I.
So it's available. It's available through most of the streaming services now. A lot of people decided that it wasn't worth seeing at the movies. In fact, I don't know. Did it come out here at the?
I don't think it did.
The cinema. I'm not sure that it did. Yeah, but it's available. It's available on QuickFlix on their pay per view. Naturally iTunes and Xbox and all those other sorts of services. So, you know, if you're interested in a bit of computer history that covers Apple, that one certainly varies in terms of the comments around it. I saw Steve Wozniak online a few weeks back on Google Plus, actually giving just his straight up opinions on some of it and where it was wrong and so on. He was saying that Pirates of Silicon Valley is probably a better story of a lot of what happened back then, and that's something that you can watch online as well. So that one's from 1999, so it goes back quite a way. But it's got a lot of that early history of Apple and Microsoft and so on. So if you're after a little bit of history of where all of this modern stuff came from, those two are ones that are an interesting watch. And I quite enjoyed the Jobs movie, despite the reviews and so on, because it's just good to see how these things are dramatized a little bit.
So it's quite tepid, the reviews.
Yeah, it's funny how things you kind of live through and work through are now history.
Yeah. I know, we're getting old, Bill. Goodness.
Did old Kutcher pull it off playing Jobs?
Oh, he got the walk down anyway.
he had a walk?
We'll leave it at that. I think that was his best, his best part once he had that nailed. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it. Now on to another company that sort of has its roots many years ago. Lenovo, who we're going back probably 3, 4, 5 years now ago, bought IBM's PC division.
2005. I think, yeah.
No, it can't be that long ago.
I'm pretty sure.
Okay. Well, anyway, some years ago, Bill's memory's probably better than mine on this one. The Chinese company Lenovo, who, what were they called back then, Bill?
They were called Legend at one point.
Okay.
They bought the IBM PC company. Everybody thought that was going to be a disaster, that, you know, mergers and so on, acquisitions in the tech industry. There's not been a good history of them. It's probably one of the most successful ones ever, actually. Because at the time, IBM's business was, it was going nowhere. They made some pretty good kit, but it was pricey and it wasn't really gripping the market. Today, Lenovo, I think is number one in PCs. Well, but it's certainly number one in some.
Yeah, I think in PCs on a global basis, and partly based on their success in their home market of China, which is the biggest market for PCs anywhere. But
the other thing about them, Paul, is they're profitable. And the other contender for number one slot is HP, who we all know are not making money from their PC division. Or if they are, it's pretty sort of marginal. Whereas Lenovo actually made, I think they do about $30 billion a year. Now, this is off the top of my head, so people at home at Wikipedia can look this up. But off the top of my head, it's about $30 billion in revenue, and I think they made about $1 billion in profit on that. So for a PC company, that's pretty solid.
I would never think of Lenovo being that popular.
Well, they're not popular in the New Zealand market, are they? And that's the point where, you know, HP have virtually, you know, around half the market or so here in New Zealand. Very, very strong. They've got a really solid, team on the ground compared to a lot of the other companies that have very few staff. So we look at Lenovo. Well, there's virtually nobody here. We look at Dell. Yeah, that mostly, you know, you order it online from offshore.
Even Apple's not here in its own.
Yeah. So, yep. And so that's the common situation. Well, whereas, you know, HP have taken the New Zealand market much more seriously than anyone else.
They've invested in it. And as they should, they have a market share as response. One of the things I discovered, I mean, years of writing about technology, one of the things I learned was if you invest properly in the New Zealand market and you actually put some management in here and don't try and run the show out of Singapore or Sydney, you'll do well. If you're going to run, if you run it out of Sydney, you're not going to do well. It's that simple.
A lot of it comes down to building the relationships across the market
and understanding what's different about New Zealanders from Singaporeans or whatever.
Australians.
Americans, yeah. Whatever, yeah. I mean, we play rugby here, guys.
So, now the point of our chat mention about Lenovo was that IBM have just announced in the last week that that this now not the you know that they're now selling the other big chunk of their business, which is their Intel based servers, which are the you know primarily the servers that that most people would see from IBM. Sure, they've still got some other high end servers that they probably charge some much bigger margins on, but their main server division is going to Lenovo as well.
It's a win-win for both companies because Lenovo gets scale. It gets them into the business sector, which they might have had difficulty getting. I mean, even though they had ThinkPad, which was essentially a business PC brand, it gets them in front of a lot of business customers who are going to need PCs with their servers. It gets them into the sharpest accounts and some of the most lucrative accounts out there. And Lenovo can handle the margins. They're operationally excellent, so they can make a profit on selling this stuff. IBM, on the other hand, it was a low-margin business for IBM, and IBM's used the money to go out and buy a cloud computing company, and they think that's where they're going to make their money in the future. Well, good luck with that, IBM, because no one really makes that much money out of the cloud, but we'll keep that one quiet.
Yeah. Well, they've got to, like most businesses today, they've got to keep reinventing themselves.
Yeah.
And, you know, let's be fair, IBM have done a very good job of reinventing themselves, and, you know, they, out of all of the old computer companies that were around, before my time, IBM is pretty much the only name that has a really dominant presence or even exists today.
Yeah, it's sort of strong brand name worldwide, globally.
Mm. Yeah, and the thing is they're brave. They have a willingness to do that, which is all credit to them.
Mm. And the interesting thing is the numbers. $2.3 billion was the deal to Lenovo. Lenovo paying for that server division. Doesn't sound like a huge amount of money when you consider it in the scheme of things and the scheme of IBM's value.
I reckon Lenovo will get that back in. I mean, if they do as well as they did with the PC business, they'll get that back in 3 years.
So they did very well with that, didn't they?
For them, I think, as I say, I think it's win-win. I think both sides win. Whether the IBM's customers win is another question. We'll see.
Mm. Well, Lenovo did a good job with the ThinkPads and most of the products. They've kept up that quality. When we were chatting earlier, Bill, you were mentioning that they've kept on management and research teams in the US that were really the key that made those products great for so many years while IBM had them. They just didn't get the profitability part right.
Well, because they got the low manufacturing costs from China. They got the best of both worlds.
Mm.
And the other thing is that it meant that they didn't have to cut corners because Lenovo could make that kit and make it well and make it at a good price. It meant that they didn't have to start cutting corners, which is what some of their rivals were doing around the same time.
Mm.
I'm very impressed with Lenovo. They're the brand you don't really hear much about in New Zealand.
No, very, very quiet here. Although, we often do get some of their gear to look at, and one of the ones we've been playing with recently is that little 8-inch Windows tablet from them, which has been good. But we'll dive back into the little tablets in a few minutes because we've got another new one here to talk about. Now, just looked up IBM's market cap. So, you know, one way of valuing a company, $187 billion today. That makes this purchase basically indicates that the x86 server business, which is what they're selling to Lenovo, sits between, you know, 1-2% of the value of the whole business is, you know, is what they're saying with what they've sold it for.
Yeah, it's about the drinks budget. So
it's they don't see it as very important. Yeah. Whereas for most people, that would be the main place that they see the IBM.
Yeah.
Name for, you know, people in the tech industry would be seeing those servers
IBM's
around the place.
Money comes from what's on those servers.
Services and software, yeah. And so on. Yeah. So, yeah, fascinating stuff. And it will be interesting to see whether Lenovo pull this one off as successfully or whether the shrinkage that we see, you know, happening within the server industry as, you know, more businesses move to the cloud impacts them, or whether they'll get the deals with the Microsofts and Amazons and Googles to actually buy some of their equipment to go into those massive cloud data centers.
No, I don't think that's what's going to happen. What I do think is there's going to be a market for servers for, you know, years to come, even if the cloud's handling more and more work. There are still going to be servers. And Lenovo is probably as well placed as anyone to meet that. Again, because they've got that low cost of manufacturing.
Mm. All right. Well, iPads in schools. There's been a bit of news on that one today. So what we've heard in a number of media have been reporting this. Is that we've got a school down in
the Bay of Plenty.
In the Bay of Plenty.
Yes, we have. I'm just pulling it up on my Android phone.
That have said they are going to give an iPad mini, I think it is, looking at the price point. They're saying about $450 each. So an iPad mini out to all the students in certain age or year brackets. It's just going to be a free thing if you go to that school.
It is.
Dad, yeah. Can I go to that school, please?
Yeah.
Mom, Dad.
That school role is going to be exponentially growing.
Well, that's the point that got me thinking. Is this a good business case for the school? They've already had half of it funded down there by, I believe it's Trust Power, you know, the old power board down there. Trust Power, I believe, are behind it as one of their funders. They'll potentially get some others. And if they can get funding in to make this happen and then push up their school role, they'll get more government funding because they've got a bigger role. They'll, you know, overall have the potential to become more successful.
Well, it's 250 iPad minis would be, what, about 100 grand?
How do I say 250 times?
About 400 bucks.
400 bucks.
Over 100 grand. Yep.
Yeah,
yep.
At least.
120K.
Yeah, I think you buy 250 at wholesale, mate.
Oh, look, that's sensational.
Well,
I don't know if there is
much of a wholesale with...
8%.
With a lot of brands these
for
days.
For decile 4 school in Papamoa. Key Papamoa.
So, I mean... Is it a good move? Does it make sense for the school? What do you think, Wal?
Yeah, I do. I think it's good having technology in the kids' hands, starting them off early adopters. And, you know, being a nation like we are, we're quite quick adopters at technology.
What I'd like to see is this happen everywhere. I think iPad's a good way. I mean, the question is iPad the best tool for this? And I think the iPad mini is an excellent tool for this. Chromebooks would be good too. I would like to see some way of funding so they get into the low decile schools. I think that's got to be an educational priority for us as a country.
But how do you do it? You're handing this out for free. Kid breaks it after 3 months. Then have you got a student that can't participate?
No, insurance
after
policy.
12 months, does the school then have to do the same? Is it the right place for it to be funded by the school? Do you need to have some other things surrounding it? And in the picture, they showed, you know, some rubber cases on the iPads, which I think is good for protection. You've got to have insurance. You've got to have security.
You might, ask the parents to stump up some insurance.
Yeah, mm. I think so. Yeah. Because
I think you want to make sure that whole picture's filled out because otherwise... Yeah, you could leave some kids behind when their one breaks or gets stolen, or you know, they get beaten up for their iPad,
because
every 8 year old kid's carrying around a you know, an expensive device.
But I want to see this up in the East Cape, up in Northland. I want to see this in those you know, schools where the kids come barefoot.
Hmm.
Yeah, yeah. I think there could be a lot of that. That could be a good initiative or an incentive for these manufacturers and then companies to get behind the schools and incentivize schools, discounting them.
Yeah.
Even university, tertiary students.
Well, I think at that sort of university level, I mean, you know, people just know that's a tool that they have to have. But for, you know, for the younger kids, their parents aren't always in a position to do that. But you know, I think having good technology in the hands of you know, our young students is as important as having the right books and curriculum and, you know, pens and pencils and everything else. You know, you can't really operate without technology, can you?
The New South Wales government did exactly that. They gave every school kid a notebook. It was, I think it was about $1,000 notebook.
Who was that, Bill?
New South Wales.
Hmm. Oh, okay.
So is a notebook more practical for school? Because you can actually feed a lot more information in terms of taking notes when you're in a lesson. You've got all of the, I guess, productivity type apps that are probably useful for a school in terms of you know, things able to probably run a little bit better on a laptop, whether it's a Bill, you were saying a Chromebook or a Windows, you know, machine now, which with Windows 8 sort of synchronizes with the cloud. Should it be a tablet or a laptop?
All of the above. The thing is the people who we're talking to, the people who are going to listen to the podcast, are probably going to be a little different to some of the kids who are in the, you know, the lower classes of schools, the ones who are in danger of being left behind. For those kids, I think a keyboard may be a bit intimidating, whereas a touchscreen is not.
Mm-hmm.
Though, and certainly a pen interface or something might be right, because they may learn they can draw before they can be comfortable typing things in.
There's more of a fun factor, isn't there, to a tablet and a laptop? No,
it's like paper and pen, isn't it?
It's more approachable. And the other thing is a tablet is very much a consumption device.
Yeah.
And so there's less pressure on you to do stuff that you maybe find a bit hard.
Right. Yeah. So if you're using a tablet, you might not be creating so much content and feeding it in there, but you still use it as a learning tool.
Yeah, and if you want to move on and put a keyboard on a tablet, you can.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I just think this is a lovely story. It's a great story, and probably in 2 or 3 years' time, we'll all schools be doing this.
Mm. All right. Well, fascinating stuff. And, I hope we get this right as a country, because I think there are a few other pieces that you need to fill out. You can't just drop technology into people's laps and hope that it will deliver the results.
No.
You've got security constraints, you know, kids getting access to porn, all sorts of things that you need to have a strategy to address. Otherwise, you know, there's a potential to end up doing more harm than good.
I think one of the areas which we're in danger of neglecting is spending money on training the teachers to use the new tools. That's where I'd like to see some money as well.
Yeah, that's actually a really
and to be
good,
fair, it doesn't take much, isn't it, to train somebody on how to use.
Oh no, but I don't mean training a teacher on how to use the tablet. I mean training a teacher on how to use the tablet as a teaching aid.
Yeah, teaching tool. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Good. A couple of other things before we wind up. Now, we've got a bunch of providers that give us a level of this sort of free online cloud storage. I guess it's sort of becoming the new place to store your data.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Microsoft have had their SkyDrive for a while, and they started out giving away 25 gigs free, which was all very nice, until they cut it back to 7 for new users that didn't get in while it was 25. Still very competitive offering. They've had a bit of dramas with Sky TV, well, Be Sky B as it is in the UK, and a bit of a trademark dispute there, Bill. Now, what's your take on this? They've had to rename SkyDrive to OneDrive. Is it going to confuse people, or it doesn't matter?
I think it's, well, some of this is ridiculous. I mean, I don't see how anyone could confuse Microsoft SkyDrive with Sky TV. I just don't. And the normal rule in these things is whichever one of the companies has got the deepest pockets and is, you know, happiest to litigate the longest is going to win this. So I don't.
Who knows the full story? I guess Microsoft also have that challenge that everyone's a partner and everyone's a customer.
Yeah.
As soon as you deal with any big business, so you know they've also got to be careful of treading on toes.
I think we all still call the Metro interface Metro, even though we're not supposed to. But
they're not very good at those trademark disputes, are they? I mean, Apple romp in with a new product, the iPhone or whatever it is. Someone else has got the trademark and, you know, they'll actually launch on the market before getting the trademark, even though they know that they're infringing. And then they'll cut a deal and walk away and everyone just wonders, how did Apple do that? Microsoft just...
Microsoft, get some better lawyers.
Yeah, I know.
Oh, I don't know. It's a whole different game they play, isn't it?
One rule for Apple, one rule for Microsoft. That's what it seems to
be. OneDrive.
Yeah. So OneDrive to rule them all. So I guess it goes with the Xbox One and OneNote.
But, hang on a minute, Paul. An interesting point about OneDrive is that means OneNote brand is more important as well. The OneNote has just changed in the last couple of days.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw that and I thought, I wonder if that is in any way linked. I wonder if that one word, one whatever is coming.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure we'll see more of it.
Yeah.
So they've updated the and their business product, which was SkyDrive Pro, becomes SkyDrive for Business. Now, tablets. We had a tablet here we wanted to have a look at before we go. In the last couple of weeks, we chatted through around the new Lenovo 8-inch tablet that I brought back from the US. There's the Toshiba 8-inch one. Now, Dell gave us hands-on very early on, before it was publicly announced, onto their 8-inch tablet, the Dell Venue Pro 8. They seem to have a very strange regime. We were talking a little bit about these companies that don't have a real New Zealand presence, and Dell is one of those companies. Now, they've been selling this product in the market for a couple of months, but their local PR team have just got their hands on one a couple of months after launch. Quite a strange way of running a company, if you ask me.
Very comical.
It's the left hand not knowing what the right hand's doing. Yeah,
we've been looking at this new Dell Venue Pro 8. Any thoughts on it, guys? What do you think of that sort of form factor?
I like the form factor myself. It looks robust and actually quite sleek. I quite like it.
It's like a big phone, isn't it? It's
kind of a phablet.
Yeah, well, yeah, no.
You don't like that term, do you, Bill?
Oh. No.
But I've been using the Lenovo one, which is a similar form factor, and the Dell just arrived today, so I'll get a bit more time on it over the next few days.
Yeah.
But I'm finding this sort of form factor is really, really good. And Windows 8 on a tablet, you take it away from PC and so on, that Metro style or modern interface actually works pretty well on a tablet and on a small device like this. And the way it synchronizes, so I fired up the Venue Pro 8 today. It popped up after I gave my credentials, like you would now on an Apple device or on a Google device. You give it your account details, and then it says, hey, look, do you want to pull down profile and so on. So it basically offered to pull down the configuration off my Lenovo tablet, pull down the apps and so on. So it's sort of, it's done a big job of making it ready to go for me. And that was just using the free, the free Cloud Sync. Rather slick, I thought.
Yeah, I like that. But something? Haven't Nokia got a device in this kind of size, which is a Windows phone device?
Yes, and I had a look at that in the States, the Lumia 1520, which is a 6-inch, I'm going to use the word again, Bill, block your ears, phablet. A six-inch smartphone. I mean, I think these will just become our large smartphones. The phablet term will probably disappear.
I think.
When you use it, I mean, gorgeous, large, full HD display that was just so bright. And, people that I've spoken to that have started using them say, look, I can't go back to my old 5-inch screen. I actually really like it. And the thing is now, although it is a telephone, you can make a phone call on it, the bulk of what we tend to do on these devices, particularly if you go for a larger screen one, is we'll The phoning isn't the main thing that I do. Actually, I'm browsing the web. I'm reading emails. You know, I'm using Flipboard, Twitter, Facebook, whatever it is. And the nice screen, in a lot of cases, means you don't necessarily need to use a tablet so much.
Can you get it in your pocket?
You can.
Right.
Well, depending on the size of your pocket.
Yeah,
I mean,
in your biggest
this top pocket I've got here, it's not going to fit very well in. And that can be a challenge some days when I'm, you know, testing out a lot of phones and I've got four phones to carry around. So, yeah. But, you know, my trouser pocket, I can fit one
well,
in each.
Can you fit in your pocket?
The Venue Pro 8 in your pocket, I think that could go in as sort of a big jacket pocket. But it wouldn't go in too much else.
I remember the very first portable pocket sized computers. They were called Pocket, you know, spelt with a Q of all things. And you could get one of them in a jacket pocket, and they were roughly that size, but they had a physical keyboard. And yeah, look, I think these devices are great. Do you know the only thing that occurs to me looking at these three Windows 8-inch devices is, man, they're a lot nicer than Android devices.
Well, it's interesting. I think they do tend to they are coming in at a, you know, at a premium price point, so you're more up towards the around that $500 mark. And so there's room for a little bit more effort on the fit and finish. The Dell actually, when they previewed that to me, they also showed me the new Android devices. Now that one's the Dell 8 Pro. There are non-Pro models that are Android based, and they're actually very similar in terms of the fit and finish. So that's something that Dell have done, is they're just going very very similar. But yeah, when we look at the sort of the metallic on the Toshiba and the Lenovo, they're pretty nice. The interesting point about the Lenovo is that's their consumer product, and they've got a ThinkPad 8, which is their an 8.3-inch tablet that I had a look at CES, which is aimed at the business market, and you know it fits in some other businessy capabilities, and you know, no doubt will be a chunk more expensive, but. I mean, as it is, that particular Lenovo tablet there, I think, is a really classy product, and it's pretty solid and reasonably lightweight too. It was certainly the lightest of that bunch.
Yeah. So is it going to be like smartphones, or is it going to be like Windows versus Android or iOS?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're in the same position where, you know, people will probably pick an ecosystem. And, yeah. I mean, let's face it, today, Android is that ecosystem that most people have jumped into with smartphones. They're growing, you know, pretty strongly in the tablet space. But, I mean, Apple's share isn't going anywhere either. So, I mean, Microsoft are fighting at the smaller end of the market at the moment. But, I think it will be a fascinating next sort of 12 to 24 months as Microsoft sees Windows 8 come onto more devices, as they tweak it and make it work a little bit better with that balance between how it works with a keyboard and mouse and how it works on a tablet. And of course they're winning a lot of market share in the lower end smartphones with these sub $200 Nokia devices, and if they can ensure the prices are competitive and that they've got strong products in the tablet space, you know, they'll probably keep winning the market share. But the problem is they're coming from so far behind.
Well, there was a story on the wires earlier this morning saying that Samsung is flirting with Windows again, with Microsoft again. And if they can get one of the big brands across...
Well, there was talk about Sony maybe coming back to a Windows smartphone as well.
But it only takes one of those mega brands
to take their market seriously and really push in, and makes a big difference. Now, there was something that came through from one of the Asian media channels around Samsung maybe pulling out of doing laptops. So that one, we don't have any official info on that, but there have been a few little rumors around that online. So that'll be fascinating what that means for the market if a player like Samsung decides to step back from...
Doesn't surprise me, Paul, especially if they're giving away free mini iPads in Bay of Plenty schools.
well, let's look at it this way, right? The laptop, the PC market in general is declining at what, 14%
a year? Not,
yeah, that kind of number. Not, yeah. And I think it's probably, I think the worst of the decline is probably behind us now, but it's still going to be declining. It's a long term, it's a market that's not going to be there. Why don't you play where the money is? Why don't you play where the action is?
Yeah, well, they don't have a big Samsung. Don't have a big slice of that particular market. They seem to, make their money in the smartphones and in the tablets. And
hang on a minute. They might not.
Well, that's certainly where they've got their market share. And I'm sure they must be making some reasonable profits off the Note 3 and the Galaxy S4, those are high end products, which I think there's room for some margin in. Bill, you probably looked at some of the profits and so on for these companies.
The financial analysts think that Samsung's not making money in that area.
Well, if they're not, then virtually nobody is other than Apple. I mean, Apple are really the standout, in terms of profitability. Yeah. And that puts them in a great position because then they've got plenty of money to throw back into their research and development and, allows them to stay strong in the market. Not that the other players aren't pouring a lot into that either to stay competitive. But I think there's plenty of competition. We're going to have a great year ahead of lots of new products. Hey, thanks, guys, for joining us. Really appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure.
Now, Bill, we can track you down on online. You're pretty regular on Twitter.
Yeah, Bill Bennett, NZ, and digital without an A, .co.nz.
Excellent. You can track me down on Twitter at Paul Spain, you can track NZ Tech Podcast on all the social media channels from Google+ to Twitter and Facebook. Well, can we find you online at all? Have you
anyone can find me. I am an open book.
Oh, there you go. Excellent. Hey, well, thanks everyone for joining us, and we'll catch you next week on the next episode. Thanks for tuning in. See ya.